to get out here every chance I get. It's not because I enjoy riding on jet airplanes, because I've done that to the point where it isn't exciting anymore. I'm here for one reason, and that is because I am convinced it is time for Jesus to come. As a matter of fact, not time for him to come. He's overdue. The Lord should have been here before. We are living on borrowed time. Or as one of my law school professors once put it, we're skating in the water. It doesn't get much later than this. And all you have to do to sense that is to open your eyes, wake up, and go out into the world in which you live. Well, I did that this morning, bright and early. I was supposed to leave my hometown about 8:30. And when I got to the airport, I discovered things were in a snarl. Because down over LA International, the visibility wasn't very good. And it wasn't just because of the usual mixture of marine layer and automobile exhaust that we call air in the LA basin. We got some fires burning down there. We waited and waited, and finally an airplane was about ready to go, and I could see problems arising because the airplane that I was supposed to depart on was talking about an 11:30 departure. That's when I was supposed to be leaving L.A. Well, I was in good fortune. The Lord takes care of these things. Because on the ramp outside the terminal was an airplane that had been intended, I think, to fly direct from Sacramento to L.A. that morning, and it couldn't get through. Airplanes were stacked up all over the basin. And so it had landed in Bakersfield, and I ran out to the gate, and I said, "You got one more seat on that airplane?" The lady said, "No, it's full." I went back and sat down, and about a minute later, she called to me, "There's one more seat there someplace," and I ran out there and got on it. And as a result, I am here. But the reason for the problem was that a good part of Southern California had gone up in smoke. Now, that's just news. I mean, we have that kind of stuff happening all over this weary world. But what was going up in smoke now was not a part of Beirut or Mogadishu or someplace in Yugoslavia. This is Malibu. Now, Malibu means a little something to me because I was born in Santa Monica, grew up there. I mean, at the foot of Sunset Boulevard. Malibu was where we used to go to the beach. Malibu was where our friends lived. And Malibu was where the money was. And I woke up this morning about 20 after 5, and suddenly it hit me. I needed to go and look at a book that we've just acquired in our home library called Last Day Events. It's a rather new compilation of Spirit of Prophecy dealing with the events of the era in which we live. And I turned to page 110, and guess what I read? "Light has been given me that the cities will be filled with confusion, violence, and crime, and that these things will increase till the end of this earth's history. Terrible shocks will come upon the earth. The lordly palaces erected at great expense will certainly become heaps of ruins. When God's restraining hand is removed and the destroyer begins his work, then in our cities the greatest calamities will come. Oh, that God's people had a sense of the impending destruction of thousands of cities now given almost entirely to idolatry." And in another place she says that the problems occurring in today's cities are an example of what is going to happen to the entire world. Now, folk, we are there. It's late. It doesn't get any later. And tonight and tomorrow, I want to share with you some practical ideas. I want to give you my conviction as I look at the world around me as to why I believe the Lord's coming is now a conclusive certainty. I do not think heaven itself has left itself the option of going back for another 40 years into the wilderness. This time, I think heaven has made an irrevocable decision. And as we go along this weekend, I think you'll see why I've come to that conclusion. Then tomorrow, I want to share with you in the 11 o'clock hour a special message that Jesus gave for people living in just this little tiny window in the long history of the world, this moment before he comes. Because in Matthew and in Luke, he left behind a parable that is so graphic, it is so clear, it is so obviously intended for an end time people when time is already borrowed and Jesus is overdue. It's so clear, it sends chills up your back. Because he leaves a warning for Christians who think it is safe to sleep one moment too long near the end of time. And in the afternoon, I want to do some practical things. A little different from the series that has appeared in this very fine brochure that American Cassette Ministries prepared. Because since Kathy and I talked about this weekend series, there has been so much in the world that it is impossible to stay current more than a few weeks. And tomorrow I'm going to share with you some rather recent research that I have done, some of it just since I returned from Japan about 2.5 weeks ago. The end result is I want Albuquerque to be ready for the coming of Jesus. Well, the pastor said I could talk about myself a little bit, and I don't intend to do much, but I have to give you a little background because it will help what I say to make more sense to you. Before I became a lawyer, I worked over 6 years in Southern California as a broadcast newscaster. And I discovered after getting just a few miles under my belt, holding that microphone on the end of a 100-foot cord and trying to pry truth out of people and dig for stories and give listeners and viewers a clearer picture of what's happening in their community and their world, I began to learn that there is a sixth sense you develop. After, for a few times, you hear people give those slippery answers that let you know they really don't want to tell the story, you finally begin to develop a sixth sense that tells you when a news story has not been told. It gives you kind of a perverse and a sometimes irreverent sense of curiosity and aggression. You learn to go for the jugular when you think people are not telling everything they have to say. And tonight, I have this old familiar feeling. It's been a long time since I've felt it, but it's coming back. This old newscaster is feeling that way again. I am convinced that you and I, as we watch the network news every evening, as we read the press, you and I are not getting all the news. The story is not being told. And we are not being told the whole story in some of the most important, globally sweeping things that are occurring in this world. And this evening I want to share one or two of those with you. When we're done, I think you will conclude that time is in fact a little shorter than perhaps we thought it was when we walked in the door. Tonight I want to share with you the stories behind the stories that I have done a little bit of research on and where I think the truth really lies. But you will not totally understand these unless you first understand a couple of remarkable Bible prophecies. And so let's quickly do a little bit of Bible review. And I invite you to join me in Revelation chapter 13, beginning with the first verse. Revelation 13, 1. And I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. Already in a few well-chosen words, there is enough biblical truth to keep us busy the rest of the evening because the Bible is so rich in symbolism that if you really begin to dig for it, you find you can go vertically almost without limit. Now, I fear that one mistake that we have made in Christianity, and yes, may I respectfully say we have made in Adventism, at least in recent years, is we read the Bible horizontally. We bounce from verse to verse rather quickly. We have become very efficient readers, as though the number of words passing through our eyeballs really matters, when in fact what matters is the depth of understanding you get from whatever it is you read. In other words, you can read the word or you can study the word, and there's an enormous difference between the two. Tonight, let's go vertical for a moment into this text. I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rise up out of the sea. What do we already know? What does a beast represent in biblical symbolism? A beast represents some kind of organized force that has the power to speak with authority and to direct your life. It may be a secular earthly kingdom. It may be a religious force. It may be some other kind of force. But a beast is something that can impose control over you or try to. I love the way the Bible uses symbolism. If they had given this stuff in plain language, some of which comes from 800 BC, do you understand how many problems you would have translating not only historical errors, but cultural differences, and finally, linguistic translation? You wouldn't understand it, but when a Bible writer paints a word picture, I saw a beast. That thing survives time, history, culture, language translations, just as clear today in English as it would be in the original Greek. And so a beast stands for some earthly power. Comes up out of the water. What else do we know? It's coming out of a populated part of the world, because water in the Bible stands for what? People. Yeah, Revelation 17 will make that real clear to you. Now, on his head, he has 10 horns. In a moment, we'll explore what 10 means. So this beast rises up out of a populated part of the earth. And there's something religious connected with it, because we have that strange word, blasphemy. Now, let's do a little cross-referencing. Turn over to Revelation 17. We pick the rest of the story up. Revelation 13 gives us the picture of this beast being born into human history. Now, Revelation 17 is a divine explanation of what it means. We begin with a verse 12 of Revelation 17. And the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. Now what do we know? We know that there are going to be kings which represent the leadership of countries, but we also know there are going to be 10 of them. What, pray tell, does that mean? In biblical symbolism, what does the number 10 refer to? Now we know what 7 means, don't we? What is 7? 7 is completeness, it's perfection of completeness, but where? Within a circumscribed area. In other words, if I were a Jew and I came in and said to you, I have gone out in the garden and I have planted 7 peas. What I would be saying is, I have planted all the peas I intend to plant. The pea crop is complete. I might have planted 400 of them, but I would say 7, because that's the Jewish way of expressing completion for a specific subject. So when the Lord completes a specific world, you see, in a great cosmos, in that limited area of the world, 7 is completion. What number would you want to use if you're talking about completion everywhere, everywhere that is imaginable to you? You would use the number 10. So when I want to say global completion, totality, everything, everywhere in this wide world, I would use the number 10. If I were a Jew, I would come in and I would say to you, I planted 10 plants in the garden. You would instantaneously know I planted the entire garden. Everything that I intended to plant is now in the ground. So that in Revelation 17, when you have 10 kings, what are you saying? You are talking about a total global completeness. Every king, every nation, every governmental structure on earth is involved in this thing. That's what the 10 means. And I suspect, folk, that the 10 toes of Daniel's image also have overtones like that. Broader than Europe, probably global. A very fine article was done in a recent issue of the Review and Herald where one of the writers suggested the same thing but from a different perspective. So what do we now know? At the end of time, there will be a force that will come up, and all the kingdoms of the world, every nation on earth, welds together into a global unit. That's where the 10 are. Now let's finish the verse. The 10 horns which thou sawest are 10 kings which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. Verse 13, these have what? Are you following along with me? These have one mind. Which tells you just before Jesus comes at the end of time, there will be globalism and the entire world will unite in a global mindset. Now, does that comport with Adventist theology? Does it sound a little bit like something written once upon a time by a lady named Ellen G. White? Do you see how Adventist eschatology is utterly biblical and can be gotten from the Word of God alone? The Spirit of prophecy is a magnificent annotation on the Word, but you can preach this to other people, never leaving the Word, see? And so now we find the whole world will go into globalism. And we go back to verse 10. They reign as kings how long? 1 hour. Now, what does that mean? I do not think it means 14 days. I don't think so. I don't think we're talking here biblical symbolism of time, a day for a year. The Greek in that particular text is a word that suggests an indefinite period of time, very short, indefinite period of time. In other words, this world will go into a global type of world coalition very briefly just before Jesus comes. Now that is what we get out of Revelation 13 and 17. Now we're ready to talk about the news stories that you haven't heard told completely when you watch the evening news. What do we know? There will be a global coalition. From Revelation 13, we know there will be one preeminent superpower. We know there will be a global consensus that will adopt rules binding on the entire world. It'll have a unique two-pronged method of enforcement. Number one, an economic embargo for those who do not go along. Number two, if the embargo doesn't work, a global death decree. Lethal force. Finally, we know that religion figures into this some way because we see this reference to blasphemy, to worship. Now, with that background, let's go to one of the biggest news stories in the last 3 years, one we have lived through, one we all remember. Let's go back to July of the year 1990. And across the Middle East, American reconnaissance satellites are scoping in on some very unusual activity headed southward in southern Iraq. They're picking up columns of equipment. I mean miles worth. And those satellites can easily pick up almost the details on a license plate from space. So they readily send back information that our analysts decipher as being Soviet equipment. These are top-of-the-line Soviet export version T-72s. We're talking about main battle tanks. They stretch for miles. What is interesting about it, though, is not just the fact that tanks are there, but alongside the tanks are what are called tank carriers. Now, a tank carrier is like a semi-truck with a big trailer on the back that you can load the tank onto and transport. Why would Hussein be moving trucks along with his tanks? Well, as a reserve military officer, I'll tell you very quickly why. You see, a tank, even a T-72, can maybe do 230 or 35 miles an hour when it's really cooking. But you put that thing on a flatbed truck and you can do 65 across the desert. In other words, this stuff is meant to move fast. Already those satellites are beginning to pick up identification of the various units, and what comes to the Pentagon and the Field Interpretation Centers is anything but reassuring news. The divisions out there, the Hammurabi Division, the Tawakalna, the Medina Luminous, the Baghdad, I'm talking Republican Guards, the ones that turned the tide in the war with Iran. These guys mean business. In other words, what is being seen by American satellites in late July of 1990 is so clear that any GS6 clerk in the CIA could tell you what it means. It means war. This stuff is headed across the border. Kuwait is dead meat. And there's enough horsepower there to move all the way on down into Saudi. It is time for immediate action by the United States. The stakes are enormous. If this happens, one-fourth of the world's oil supply will immediately fall into the hands of one petty dictator in the Middle East. It is time to double security at the gates of U.S. military bases. I mean, you don't just look at the decal on the window, you check ID when people come in. It's a time to cancel leaves and send out warning notices to the reserves to stand by. They may be called up. It may be a time to pick the red telephone up and go head of state to head of state, because this is how serious this can be. In other words, there is big trouble on the horizon. Maybe with enough sword rattling and enough of the kind of body language that native nations engage in when they really want to act serious, maybe this invasion doesn't have to happen. Yet with all that information in hand, just before the invasion takes place, what does the United States do? You know what they do? Nothing. No, that's not quite right. They don't do nothing. They do worse than nothing. On three separate occasions in late July in 1990, when there's still a chance to turn it around, maybe, the United States sent messages to Saddam Hussein that suggest pretty clearly that if he crosses the line, nothing serious will happen. Now, you got a little of this in the news, and then it dried up. It went away. You remember all that talk about April Glaspie, the ambassador to Iraq, talking with Saddam Hussein? A little bit of this, you know, stirred up in the public mind. A little of congressional inquiry took place. Then all of a sudden it disappeared, and we didn't hear any more about it. Why? Why was the news story not told? But there are a couple other things maybe you do not know. Why was it that on July 31, 1990, there is an assistant secretary of state who appears before the House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee for Middle Eastern Affairs, and he says, and I quote, makes a big point of saying, Kuwait has no defensive treaty with the United States. And why is it at almost the same time Margaret Tutwiler, that gal you see every once in a while as a spokesman for the State Department, gets on the international media and makes a point of saying the United States has no obligation to go to the aid of Kuwait? Why? Well, to answer the question, I think you have to ask one. What was the effect of the invasion of Kuwait and the resulting Persian Gulf crisis? What did it produce? In a simple sentence, it forced the world to combine in a way the world had never done before. Global unification. I mean, we're talking everybody, including Japan. Japan, which is so pacifistic, they have never before even wanted to talk about sending their defense forces anywhere from the home islands. They look at this monster and all of a sudden they recognize the problem. If this thing goes as bad as it looks like it can go, they got 60 days worth of petroleum stored in the islands, after which they're driving ox carts down the expressway from Tokyo to Yokohama. Their industry is gone. What about Europe? Not quite as dependent as Japan, but still terribly dependent. If this thing goes bad, the European economy can be forgotten. Their industry is also jeopardized. What about Russia? What happens in the Persian Gulf puts the Russian administration to the most cruel of all dilemmas. You know why? Because on one side is this fellow by the name of Shevardnadze. You ever heard of him? He is the foreign minister. He and Gorbachev are eagerly trying to mend fences with the West. They want to have détente because the Russian economy is in the final stages of implosion. Their economy is going to collapse. If they have any hope of saving the Soviet Union, it will be with Western money. They do not dare aggravate the West. While at the same time in the Red Army there are generals like Yazov and Moiseyev, the chief of staff and the defense minister, who will one day plot a coup against Gorbachev, and who are saying, get in there and help your client state. It is time to help the Iraqis, you fools. Don't you realize what Hussein is trying to do? We are going broke, and here's our chance to save the economy, because if Hussein gets a hold of the oil, the price is going to go from $16 a barrel to $22. That will mean $20 to $40 billion for the USSR. We might be able to hold our country together. So within Russia, there is this enormous, terrible tension that is generated simply by allowing Hussein to cross the line. Within months, the Soviet Union will be gone, in part as a result of the Persian Gulf. In other words, allowing Hussein to do what he did forced almost the entire world to unify. Now, on September 11, 1990, what did George Bush get on television and say to the American people? He said, and I quote, a new partnership of nations has begun. The crisis in the Persian Gulf, as grave as it is, also offers a rare opportunity to move toward a historic period of cooperation. Out of these troubled times, a new world order can emerge. End of quote. January 29, 91 rolls around. He's giving his State of the Union message. Once again, he says, I challenge the world to a big idea, a new world order. Now, can it be that behind the scenes of our daily news, in which we think we're getting the explanation, and we may not be, there are powerful forces that wanted this very thing to happen, and that may have had that idea in mind for decades? In other words, are we less actors in this world than we are spectators watching something happen that has already been designed? Well, let me tell you something. The idea of a new world order is nothing new. I was in a New Age bookstore about a year ago. I was doing some research on another topic, and I got kind of interested in looking up and down the rows of shelves at the titles. And guess what I found in their political section? A book that was printed and copyrighted in 1945, and would you like to guess what appeared on the cover? The interesting phrase, New World Order. 1968, Nelson Rockefeller speaking in New York City. The New York Times quotes him as saying, and I quote, he called for the creation of, guess what? A new world order. 1976, candidate Jimmy Carter is running for president. Do you remember him? You know what he said? I'm quoting, we must replace balance of power politics with world order politics. Then comes the year 1990. And there is an ex-Jesuit priest by the name of Malachi Martin, one of the most fascinating and flamboyant individuals writing today. And he brings out a book that is entitled Keys of This Blood. It's a book you've no doubt heard about. Probably many of you have read it. We oftentimes fixate on the short title, but what is the rest of the title on the cover? Keys of This Blood, Pope John Paul II versus Russia and the West for control of the what? New World Order. Now let me read you the opening statement of Malachi Martin's book. As I do so, I want to make it real plain that I am fully aware that in a recent issue of the Review, a history professor analyzed this book and came to the conclusion, apparently, that it really doesn't have that much to say to Adventists about the end of time, because the man is a gadfly in the Catholic Church and out of touch with reality. Well, let me tell you something, folks. What I have read in this book, ignoring the portions of the book that deal with the internal problems of the Catholic Church, what impresses me about this book is not whether Malachi Martin is a prophet, because we know he's not. What impresses me is that a Catholic that close to the Vatican was willing to stand up and say out loud what I'm about to read to you. That alone makes this book worth reading. Now let's turn to the first page of the book and let me share with you why I feel concerned. Here is the future according to Father Martin. And I quote, willing or not, ready or not, we are all involved in a global competition about who will establish the first one-world system of government that has ever existed in the Society of Nations, about who will control each of us. Once the competition has been decided, the world and all that is in it, our way of life as individuals, our families, our jobs, our trade and commerce, our religions, even the badges of our national identity, will all have been powerfully and radically altered forever. No one can be exempted from its effects. No sector of our lives will remain untouched. End quote. Now, before we let historians tell us this stuff doesn't mean anything, let's go back into the Word of God and see if Revelation 13 foresaw just about exactly what Malachi Martin is describing. Revelation 13, 11. And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. And he exerciseth all the power of the first beast before him, and causeth the earth and them that dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. Now look at verse 16. And he causeth all, What did Malachi Martin say? No one will be exempted. No sector of our lives will remain untouched. What did he say would happen? Our trade and commerce, our jobs, our badges of national identity. Listen as Malachi Martin's words echo in your ears as now we turn to the prophet John. Verse 16 of Revelation 13. And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, and that no man might buy or sell, save he that hath the mark, the name, or the number. That's a global economic embargo. Don't tell me that's impossible, folk. We did it in the autumn of 1990 against Iraq. The individual who seemed to be threatening the majority of the world was embargoed out of trade and commerce. That's a buy-sell decree. And I want to make it real plain. My purpose here is not to criticize Desert Shield or Desert Storm. We had to do what we did. What I'm saying is that history has already done a practice run for what you and I will live with, I don't think, very far in the future. Now we back up to verse 15. Look at this one. Here's the second element of Desert Storm. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast and cause that as many as would not worship the image should be what? Killed. That's a death decree. You want to see what a death decree looks like? Get out some of your old footage from CNN that you may have videotaped off the air. And look at what happened after midnight, January 15, 1991. That, my friends, is a death decree. That's what it looks like. So Malachi Martin tells us we're headed for a new world order in which nothing is exempt, nobody is exempt, and every facet of our lives will be in some way affected. Now, on the very next page of that book, he tells us when it's going to happen, and at least by his account, it doesn't linger very long. Keys of this blood, page 16. This new world order is not something around a distant corner of time. It is imminent. It will be introduced and installed in our midst by the end of this final decade of the second millennium. In other words, by 1999. Oh, there's one more thing I should share with you. It's from page 492. Maybe this will be of interest. The Pope insists, and I'm quoting again, the Pope insists that men have no reliable hope of creating a viable geopolitical system unless it is on the basis of Roman Catholic Christianity. In other words, the New World Order will in fact be based on a moral code from the Mother Church. Now let's see where this leads us. One thing you have to understand is that the formation of strong independent nations in Europe, the time of the Renaissance, was one of the factors that sounded the death knell for monolithic Roman Catholicism in Europe. Now, I understand that in the 16th century, there were people like Martin Luther who were hammering at it from the theological point of view. But Martin Luther would have never survived the Inquisition had it not been for the electors in Germany who had political power enough to spirit him away, hold their hands up against the forces of the Pope, and say, the man is going to be safe here. See? So the fact that Martin Luther could operate as he did was in part dependent upon the fact that independent nation-states were beginning to organize in Europe, and thus the formation of strong independent nations has long been a problem for the Church. Now you notice back here in the opening pages of Malachi Martin's book where he said the badges of our national identity will be radically altered forever. Powerfully altered, no one can be exempted. What he's really saying here is that we'll get away from this idea of strong independent nations. We are once again going to face a globalization where we're citizens not so much of a country, but of a world. Let me share with you one more quote here that really makes it plain, because once again, Malachi Martin is not just spouting nonsense that we can dismiss with a cavalier article in a church paper. This stuff is historically correct. Listen to page 354. Europe never relied on natural protection of snow or man-made defenses of a 1,500-mile Chinese wall or on a river as the symbol of its continuity. Europeans housed their hopes and found their believing trust beneath the domes and Gothic spires of the churches they built. They built cathedrals, the living symbols of the reality in their lives, the Catholic faith. Europe's protection was centered on its faith. Its identity was provided in the papacy. The unifying principle of its civilization lay in its common acknowledgement of the primacy of the Pope. Now that is in fact historically correct, and that is the position of any sincere conservative Catholic like Malachi Martin. So the point I'm making is that the goal, at least from one very powerful source determined to have a new world order, would be the erosion of independent national strength and a blending together of the nations of the world in a new world order. Let me conclude with one more statement here from Malachi Martin's book, because it leads us into the next topic that we have to understand. On page 22 of the book, he puts it this way. For 1,500 years, Rome had kept as strong a hand as possible in each local community around the wide world. That had been the Roman view until 200 years of inactivity had been imposed on the papacy by the major secular powers of the world. It was the first distinguishing mark of John Paul's career as pontiff that he had thrown off the straitjacket of papal inactivity in major world affairs. On his trip to Poland in 1979, barely 8 months after his election, he signaled the opening of the millennial endgame. Now that last sentence is important enough, I'm going to read it again because it leads us to a clear understanding of what we'll talk about next. Pope John Paul II went to Poland in 1979, barely 8 months after he was elected. Malachi Martin says that that trip to Poland was his, quote, signal of the opening of the millennial endgame. In other words, the competition that would produce a unified world by the year 2000. 1979. Now let me ask you folk a question. Do you remember a few years ago within Adventism when a major, unique pillar truth of Adventism, without which, folk, we have no real reason to exist as a separate church, a major pillar truth was openly questioned in an Adventist setting? Do you remember what year that was? 1979, late in the year. Where did the challenge come from? It came from Australia. Now, let me talk about Australia. I just returned from there. I did a lecture tour down in Sydney and Melbourne and places in between in July. I have been to Australia many times. I've lost count, frankly, of how many times I have been there. It's a lovely country. It is filled with interesting and charming people. It is an important country for this world. Every other time I was there, I didn't notice anything particularly unique politically. This time, I did. As a matter of fact, to put it rather frankly and rather bluntly, something very strange and very bad is happening in Australia. And I first began to be introduced to that as I traveled around the country and began to talk to people. The clearest repetitive remark I got was from people who had something to do with farming. Australian agriculture is just disappearing. Now, when you consider the fact that Australia is an island continent with no contiguous border, so that if they cannot produce their own food, they've got a real problem. It has to be imported by air or by ship. The point becomes even stranger. And yet, repeatedly, people would tell me farmers are going to the bank to get loans. They are being told something they never heard before. The bankers are saying, we don't have any use for you small-time operators. You want to stay in business in Australia, you get big or you get out. And so the farming industry in Australia is collapsing. That was the first hint I had that something was wrong. I picked that up down in the southern part of New South Wales. Came back to Sydney. I was doing a lecture series there for the public on world events, the world economy, and some of the events that we're now living through. One night, one of the people that was at my program, this was, you know, designed for the general public. It wasn't a church meeting per se. One of the people who had been there called up a talk show host in Sydney. The guy is a fascinating individual by the name of Brian Wilshire. And he said, you've got to call this guy up and interview him on the air, because what he's saying out there plugs into what you have been saying, Brian, for several months about what is happening in Australia. So where I was staying out in northwest Sydney, the telephone rang. It was a radio station downtown. They said, would you be willing to talk on the air with Brian Wilshire? I agreed to do it. We talked for half an hour. We talked about the nuclear situation in the world. I shared with him some information he had not yet heard of about the probability that at least six Soviet nuclear devices are already missing. They can't account for them in Russia. The inventories do not account for them. We think they're probably in Iran and Syria. So we talked about events like this, and he began to share with me some of his concerns about his own country. And I discovered that Brian Wilshire is not just a radio talk show host, he is an author. He's written a book which is a runaway bestseller down in Australia. It is called The Fine Print. And it, like Keys of This Blood, has a longer subtitle. You know what it is? The Fine Print, Australia's Special Role in the New World Order. Brian Wilshire is convinced that his country is being used by forces he cannot totally identify as a guinea pig to decide where the rest of the world will go when the bugs are worked out of the system. Now, let me share with you some of his concerns. For example, in Australia, which is rich in minerals, it is so wealthy in minerals, it could be self-sustaining. It could be an exporter of finished products to the world as it used to be. It is now losing one business every 15 minutes. Every quarter hour, another business disappears from Australia. It is rich in farmland, yet it is losing farmers at the rate of one an hour. Since the mid-1970s, one half of all Australian industry has disappeared. It's gone. So that Australia is now reduced to exporting its iron ore and its coal at the lowest end of the economic scale, while it has to import the finished goods, which you pay for, way up there at the top end of the scale. The effect on the Australian economy is so bad that while I was there, I found it helpful to somebody to loan them about $4,500 Australian. Before I left the country, they wrote me a check. 3 weeks later, when I came to the United States, deposited it in my home bank, converted it from Australian dollars to U.S., guess what, folk? I had lost 210 U.S. dollars because the Australian dollar is falling so fast. Why is this happening? Brian Wilshire has an interesting question on page 5, Roman numeral 5 of his book. Let me read it to you. How did we get into this mess, and how could we get out? Did we fall, or were we pushed? Could all our financial and political problems be explained by human error, or could there be a common thread, an explanation involving the unfolding of a deliberate plan? From the breakdown of the family unit to crime and unemployment, all the nation's problems seem to have one common denominator. Now let me stop a second and see if you folk can figure out what it is. What would the common denominator be? Collapsing industry, a declining dollar, crime, unemployment, losing their agriculture, losing their industry, becoming a dependent nation. What would the common denominator be? Well, let me give it to you in Brian Wilshire's words. The common denominator would be this. They had the effect of reducing our ability to operate as an independent nation. Now, are the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle beginning to assemble themselves in your mind? Is all of this just wild imagination? Is this just a bunch of Aussies that have had too much Tui's beer to drink and are sitting around bored and trying to figure out something to excite each other with? Or could there be something to this man's concern? Well, before you write off his concern, I got a question for you. What happened to the USSR? Let me tell you what happened to the USSR. the Soviet Union was destroyed from the outside. We owe this to the exceptional journalistic talents of a guy by the name of Bob Woodward. Now, you remember Watergate, right? You remember Woodward and Bernstein, who uncovered this and thus plunged the United States into some of its most profound investigative journalism? You may agree or disagree with the results of that. Some of them were rather tragic, but what kind of reporting they do is excellent. Bob Woodward, one of the Watergate team, began to research the collapse of the Soviet Union. By February 24 of 1992, he had finished his work and he published it in a special Time magazine issue, which came out on the newsstands with the cover story, Holy Alliance. We now know from clear historical documentation that in fact the Soviet Union's demise wasn't something that happened in the early 90s. It was something that was planned on a June day in 1982, when two men, President Reagan and Pope John Paul II, met in the Vatican Library and decided it was time to rewrite the map of Europe, get rid of communism in Eastern Europe, and just maybe, if you could go for the brass ring, destroy communism in the Soviet Union. You know what their plan was? I did a whole talk on this. I'm not going to repeat it because American Cassette Ministries has it in the series I did out in California a little over a year ago. The title of that particular series was also Adventism and the New World Order. And quite frankly, I would like to address the title of this series I'm doing here in Albuquerque under a different title because we're really taking a very different approach here. What we're talking about here is the Advent and getting ready for it. But in any event, what happened was that the plan quite simply was that the Pope would make war on communism from within using his Catholic population in places like Poland. He knew what every wise military general knows, and that is the enemy you cannot destroy from outside, you may destroy where? From within. He then put the Soviet Union between the jaws of an enormous military pincher movement. He was attacking from within in an ideological way. Now, the United States came from outside and declared not conventional war on Russia, but war of a different sort. It was economic war. World War III has been fought in this world. It was not a conventional war. It was an economic war. We declared economic war on the Soviet Union, and within 9 years, they were bleeding to death before an astonished world. You and I did not know what was going on because we hadn't heard the rest of the story on the evening news. I didn't pick it up till 1990. When I was reading the U.S. Naval Institute proceedings, 1990, 1991, right along in there, and one of the writers in that journal that monthly talks about warfighting doctrine mentioned the economic war we had declared on Russia. Suddenly it came clear in my mind. I realized that I had been living through World War III and I hadn't even known it. During the 80s. By the way, that is what's wrong with our economy today. You look at the graphs, you pick up something like 1995, that book that has all those graphs in it showing the deficit in this country, and you will discover that for the first time in the history of this republic, we went into triple-digit deficit figures in 1982, the same year that it was decided the United States would use its enormous economic force to crush the Soviet Union. Within just a period of about 6 or 7 years, we had gone from $1 trillion to $4 trillion in national debt. World War III ruined the Soviet Union. It also probably ruined our economy. And I think that will propel us into an economic problem that will help to bring on the coming of Jesus. We'll get to that in just an instant. So when we talk about something big enough to threaten a nation like Australia, you can't write it off as just, you know, the concerns of an overwrought Australian newscaster, because it's happened on a much bigger scale in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. Now, we're ready to listen to what Malachi Martin had to say. Willing or not, ready or not, we're all involved in a no-holds-barred global competition about who will establish the first one-world system of government we have ever seen. The question is, are there awesomely powerful forces in our world that are determined to push this planet toward globalism? Benjamin Disraeli, the Prime Minister many, many years ago of England, put it this way. The world is governed by very different personages than what is imagined by those who are not behind the scenes. And Woodrow Wilson put it in another very similar way when he said, "There is a power somewhere so organized, so subtle, so watchful, so interlocked, so complete, so pervasive, that people better not speak above their breath when they speak in condemnation of it." There are forces in this world, my friends, that we do not know about, that are far more powerful than we know. Now, what plans might they have for you and me? Have they written our future? Well, let's go back to Australia. I want to close very quickly. There is something significant about Australia's recent development of some legislation that I want to share with you. They've established something called the Human Rights Commission. Well, I guess your first reaction would be, well, what in the world is wrong with that? Human rights are something we should defend, right? Why not have a commission to defend human rights so that if, in fact, somebody is wrongly dealt with, there's a commission to which they can go? Well, in principle, there's nothing wrong with human rights. We talk about it here in America all the time. But let me share with you how the Australian Human Rights Commission operates. Number one, it can demand that you appear before it at your own expense. How is that process triggered? All they have to do is get a complaint from an anonymous accuser that you have done something in violation of human rights. You are not entitled to discover who that individual is, nor will you ever be, nor are you entitled to discover what the evidence is against you. But you do have to appear. You have to appear at your own expense, and there is no right to presence of an attorney. The proceedings are secret. The tribunal is not accountable to Parliament, and there is no appeal to the Crown. By the way, if you weren't happy with a decision the Human Rights Commission made against you, where would you go to appeal it? You know where? Would you like to take a guess? Where would you go? The United Nations. Now, what does all that remind you of? It's a word that begins with I. Go back about 400 or 500 years, and in Europe and other countries that are subject to Europe's influence, you can be called before a trier of fact upon the accusation of an unnamed accuser. You are not privileged to have an attorney. You are not privileged to know the evidence against you. The proceedings are private. And to whom do you appeal? Another powerful central international body called the Vatican. I am describing the Inquisition. What Australia has done with their Human Rights Commission is to recreate something so remarkably reminiscent of the Inquisition that you can put the two side by side and see very, very little difference. Now, English common law is the place where human rights were born. You ever heard of the Magna Carta? John Locke, the formers of the Constitution of the United States, drew their ideas of human liberty from English thinkers. Why would that be going on in Australia? Is there a possibility that there are powerful forces out there that we cannot identify but that are moving, just as Malachi Martin said they will, toward a world that is so very different that every facet of your life in the foreseeable future is at least designed to be very different from what you now enjoy? Look around you. One of the mightiest forces in human history, the USSR, the Soviet Empire, collapses after it is defined as being an obstacle in the way of a new world order based upon a religious ethic. Smaller nations like Australia lose their industry and their agriculture, become economically dependent, and in ways that are reminiscent of the Inquisition, begin to abridge human rights. Meanwhile, something's happening in America. Are you watching it? In 1975, the United States was the biggest lender in the world. We were an exporter of money. We were the largest lender in the world and the largest lender in the history of the human race. We were a net creditor nation. 1986, 11 years later, and just 4 years after that meeting in the Vatican, the United States is the world's largest debtor nation. And we are roaring beyond a $4 trillion debt. You realize that within the foreseeable future, it will take all of the income tax revenue that the federal government produces every year to fund the interest on our national debt. Something's gone wrong here. Well, that much you know. If you get up in the morning and open your eyes, you know it. But did you know the rest of the story you haven't heard there? Were you aware that there is legislation on the books in America where you and I could be forced as taxpayers to fund the debts of foreign nations as well? What I'm talking about is a world that now collectively owes $25 trillion. Back in 1980, it was passed. It was called the Monetary Control Act. Were you aware when it happened? The Monetary Control Act can be used by the Federal Reserve to issue U.S. dollars for foreign debt. Question we might want to ask ourselves is, are the forces of history or are other conscious, very, very well-planned forces pushing the United States toward a situation where we may face such a global economic reverse that you and I would be willing to accept a globalism that we would have never considered accepting without the kind of problems that we faced? Can it be, as Wilshire said, this wasn't an accident, it was planned? Well, there's another individual in the world that's kind of interesting, and his name is Pat Robertson. And he's written a book with the title of, guess what? The New World Order. In a moment, we'll close with his convictions, and if nothing else tonight has waked you up, this one will. Pat Robertson put it this way. Take it or leave it, but it's kind of interesting to hear his perspective. It is as if a giant plan is unfolding. Europe sets a date for its union. Communism collapses. A hugely popular war is fought in the Middle East. A new world order is announced, and then a financial collapse accelerates the move toward a world monetary system. That much of his book just may be more true than we realize. Now, once again, let's go back to Australia. When I was there, I did another talk show, only this time I went downtown Sydney to the studio and did it because I was wanting to make people aware of the meetings we were holding and hopefully interest them in attending. I did my little stint on the air in the studio there with the talk show host of that particular program. I was walking down the hallway ready to go downstairs to the parking garage when by me walked none other than the Attorney General of Australia. I mean the Federal Attorney General. He walked into the studios, and I said to myself, I've got to hear why this guy is here and what he has to say. And do you know why he was there? Because Australia is on the verge of passing some rather strange new legislation. This is called the Anti-Vilification Bill. You know what it provides? It provides that if you either say or have in your possession written material that would tend to be kind of vilifying or casting an evil sort of aura about somebody else's religion, you can be guilty of a criminal offense. Let me read it to you in part. A person must not speak or behave towards a person in a manner that vilifies that person on the ground of his religion. Penalty for a first offense, 20 penalty units or imprisonment for 2 months. Second offense, 3 months in prison. Third offense, 6 months. Now, that much is of concern, but let me read you the next provision. A person must not possess written material that is vilifying with the intention of publishing or displaying it and thereby creating or increasing hatred of any group of persons on the ground of their religion. Now, do you see any implications in that? What would happen if you possessed or gave away a book like Great Controversy? Well, I listened to that good gentleman's explanation of how this had no relevance whatever with respect to religious liberty, and I wasn't, I confess, totally convinced. Why would all of this be happening? Recall the Human Rights Commission, there's no appeal to the Crown. You got to go to the UN. Why would there be a problem appealing to the crown? Anybody have an answer for that one? If you were appealing to the crown, to what kind of forum would you be appealing? A Protestant forum. Now, the interesting fact is that Australia is heavily, heavily Roman Catholic. Lots of Irish people there, lots of Italian people there. The Prime Minister is Catholic. The entire front bench of Parliament is Catholic. 6 out of the 7 High Court justices are Catholic. Australia is now urging, in some quarters, that they just split off from Great Britain altogether and form their own brand new republic. Now maybe do you understand why? Because Great Britain is a Protestant power. Let's close now very quickly. Human history is replete with examples of what goes wrong when you mix religion and politics. Back in the time of the Inquisition, some rather cruel things were done. There's a fellow by the name of William Manchester. He's written a book entitled The World Lit Only by Fire. If you really want to get a very readable, very clear, and sometimes embarrassingly frank view of the Middle Ages, get this book. William Manchester is the guy who wrote The Death of the President after John Kennedy was killed and so forth. His book is not written from a religious perspective. I can guess from reading what he writes here that he has no religious convictions at all, except perhaps scorn. He is very, very frank about what went wrong both among the Protestants and Catholics during the Middle Ages. Let me give you a little taste of what inquisitional lifestyle was like. And I'm going to read it to you from page 58 of his book. This will tell you what happened to one good gentleman back in the era of the Inquisition. As the priests flung their candles down and stamped them out, the parishioners trembled for the knight's soul, which they knew had very little chance of surviving. The wayward baron was now an outlaw. Eventually, he bought back his salvation at a formidable price. First, he donated his entire fortune to the bishop. Then he appeared at the chancel barefoot, wearing a pilgrim's robe. For 24 hours he lay prostrate before the high altar, praying and fasting. Then he knelt while 60 monks and priests clubbed him. As each blow fell, he yelled, "Just are thy judgments, O Lord." Then William Manchester concludes by saying, "The medieval church was strong on law and order." I don't have time tonight, and I may not this entire weekend, but I am convinced, and I could share with you some incidents in our society that tell me, what some of the greatest problems that you and I will face in terms of personal liberty will be just good people, tired to death of gangs and graffiti and kids getting shot in their grammar school playground. And they're going to say it's time to get back to law and order, and by the way, let's tack on a little respect for God, because since we lost a concept of our responsibility to a divine being, look what's happened to our country. I think the time of trouble will be a time in which good people are trying desperately to bring back a time of law and order. So it was in the time of the Inquisition. The Inquisition was just people wanting to enforce law and order. Now, what does Maranatha say? It tells us that Catholics have got no monopoly on this kind of mistake. Maranatha, page 190. Protestants of the United States will be foremost in stretching their hands across the Gulf to grasp the hand of spiritualism and to clasp hands with the Roman power. And Manchester tells us the Protestants were no prize either. Let's turn now to his book, page 191. His book, A World Lit Only by Fire. Now we'll see what it was like to live in Geneva during the Reformation. Geneva was ruled by a fine reformer named John Calvin, who had taken truth miles into a direction it needed to go, but had not yet learned the lesson that the Lord designed us to be free. Well, on page 190 of the book, Manchester puts it this way. John Calvin's Geneva represented the ultimate in repression. It was known as the Protestant Rome. In effect, a police state ruled by a consistory of 5 pastors and 12 lay elders. One morning, Calvin found a poster on his pulpit accusing him of gross hypocrisy. A suspect was arrested. No evidence was produced, but he was tortured day and night for a month until he confessed. Screaming with pain, he was lashed to a wooden stake. His feet were nailed to the wood. Ultimately, he was decapitated. Calvin put it this way, and I quote, "When the papists are so harsh and violent in defense of their superstitions, are not Christ's magistrates ashamed to show themselves less ardent in defense of the sure truth?" Back in those days, attendance at church and sermons was compulsory. Calvin himself preached 3 or 4 times a week. Refusal to take the Eucharist was a crime. And these 5 pastors and 12 bishops, or 12 lay elders, would periodically enter homes to be sure nobody was cheating the system. You see, legislation specified the number of dishes to be served at each meal and the color of garments to be worn. Sometimes we get a little bit tunnel vision, I think, when we worry about the Catholics. Folk, the Protestants have done the same thing. Now, with that in mind, I want to close because I think it tells us just how near the end we are. Maranatha, page 195. Human enactments, laws manufactured by satanic agencies under a plea of goodness and restriction of evil, will be exalted while God's holy commandments are despised. Great Controversy 591 puts it this way. They will lament the great wickedness in the world and second the testimony of religious teachers that degraded state of morals is the cause for our problems. Those who honor the Bible Sabbath will be denounced as enemies of law and order, as breaking down the restraints of society and causing anarchy. Now, I know it's late, but we got to stop for a second. If she says that those who obey the Bible Sabbath and the law of God are blamed for causing anarchy, then what do you know lies in our future? Anarchy. That's not hard to imagine in the LA Basin. Maybe it isn't hard to imagine in parts of Albuquerque. Law is disappearing, folk. It's getting scary. So she goes on to say, in legislative halls and courts of justice, a false coloring will be given to their words, the worst construction put upon their motives. Even in free America, rulers and legislators, in order to secure public favor, will yield to the popular demand for a law enforcing Sunday observance. And now let's close by going back to Pat Robertson, page 233. He also is concerned about the collapse of law and order. And in his book, The New World Order, page 233, he says, "It is one of the supreme ironies of history that the former communist bloc nations are desperately seeking to repair the moral wreckage wrought by their nations, or I should say wrought upon their nations by an official policy of atheism, while irreligious liberal groups like Americans United for Separation of Church and State are doing everything in their power to drive the U.S. into the same moral abyss." Do you know what Americans United for Church and State is? That's basically an Adventist organization designed to try to promote religious liberty. Well, he goes on to say, "The Ten Commandments are for our own good. As Jesus Christ put it, the Sabbath was made for man. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy is a command for the personal benefit of each citizen. Our minds, spirits, and bodies demand a regular time of rest. Perhaps God's greatest gift to mankind's earthly existence is the ability to be free from work one day a week. Laws in America that mandated a day of rest from incessant commerce have been nullified as a violation of the separation of church and state. In modern America, shopping centers, malls, stores of every description carry on their frantic pace 7 days a week. Before our eyes, we watch the increase of chronic burnout, stress breakdowns, nervous disorders, and mental and spiritual exhaustion cauterizing the souls of our people. I never gave the issue of a day of rest much thought until I read Isaiah. If you turn away your foot from the Sabbath, from doing your pleasure on my holy day, then you shall delight yourself in the Lord, and I will cause you to ride on the high places of the earth. I determined to remake my Sundays according to the biblical model. Now, I know I've talked a long time tonight. One of the reasons was that I don't want to talk anymore this weekend about world events necessarily, because I want to really concentrate from this point on what we do about getting ready for a coming of Jesus that is so near you can feel it. But what I wanted to give you tonight is a sense of how rapidly, beneath the surface, on those news stories you never hear, totally reported, mighty currents are sweeping us, sometimes not even aware, toward a shore we never intended to reach. And so I just suggest to you this evening, it is time to wake up, to be aware. And as Jesus said, when these things begin to come to pass, rejoice and look up, for your redemption draweth nigh.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.